ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm your host today, Mike Keyes. Today, I'm going to be talking with Cornelius Hunter, who is a graduate of the University of Illinois, where he earned a PhD in biophysics and computational biology. And he's an adjunct professor at Biola University. One of the books that I've enjoyed most that he's written is called Darwin's God, Evolution and the Problem of Evil. So welcome to the show, Cornelius.
Mike, it's great to talk with you again.
All right. So you deal with science and religion issues, and one of the big issues in that domain is determinism and free will. And I understand you particularly have read some material recently produced by the German theoretical physicist Sabine Hosenfelder. That might be a kind of a kicking off point, but I know the general topic of free will and determinism is an important one for science and religion, and relating that to issues of fine-tuning is also an interesting way of diving into this topic. So what has been some of your recent work on this general topic of determinism and free will, Dr. Hunter?
Well, you know, Mike, there's several ways we can look at this, and probably makes sense for us to walk through this sequence. As usual, a good starting point is the historical backdrop, and there is quite a historical context here that, you know, so often it's ignored, and discussions like this go on in a vacuum as though it's just some scientific philosophical discussion. History really makes a difference. And we have to go back to Aristotle with the sublunar and superlunar regions. Newton, you know, a couple thousand years later, Newton came along. Aristotle thought that up in the sky was different than down here for obvious reasons. Up in the sky, things go sideways. Down here, things go up and down. Up in the sky, things are perfect. Down here, things are, you know, imperfect, right?
Yeah.
And so he had the sublunar and superlunar regions. Newton realized, no, it's actually all unified. And kind of in a fulfillment of Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, his universal law of gravity governed both the apple falling from the tree and the moon rounding the earth. And it's not that someone went up to the moon and tested it. It's not that someone went out to Pluto and tested gravity, but it's that the sublunar and superlunar regions were now resolved.
Yes.
We have to understand that historical context. We use the word universal gravity, Newton's universal law of gravity. And so, but there came a problem with this. And that is, you know, Newton realized that every once in a while you have planetary alignments, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, every once in a while, they're going to all line up. And their little puny little gravitational attractions between them are going to add up. And you're going to have a perturbation to the finely tuned, Newton's finely tuned solar system. And by the way, that was one of Newton's arguments for design. These laws were so elegant, but it wasn't just the laws. And that's an interesting facet of intelligent design. It's not just laws, it's the way things are arranged.
So the initial conditions that was initially set up,
so
that it would endure for quite a while.
yeah. And so the position and the velocity of all of the planets and all of their moons are very important. When you have these planetary alignments, you're going to have these perturbations, and that fine tuning could get nudged a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Newton suggested, and it was just a suggestion. He takes a lot of flack for this. It was just one sentence. He said, maybe it will be in want of a reformation occasionally throughout the eons. And in other words, God will come in with a divine finger and just nudge things a little bit to make sure that it's back in its place. And those velocity vectors are what need to be for fine tuning. That caused quite a consternation because it violated and contradicted the greater God theology that God would never create something that doesn't work. And he would never have to go and intervene. Who's the greater clockmaker? A clockmaker who makes a clock that works, or a clockmaker who makes a clock that then needs to go and move the hands? Obviously, the greater God is the guy who makes the clock that works. Likewise, for God of the universe, so argued the Lutherans and the Anglicans. So Newton brashly violated the greater God theology, and there was a cultural religious mandate for a stable solar system. And when you have a cultural religious mandate for something, you're going to get a solution. And 100 years later, along came Pierre Laplace with his, you know, fantastic work. He's a great scientist, the French Newton. And in his Mécanique Céleste, he solved this problem and showed that the gravitational perturbations that Newton worried about would actually kind of iron themselves out. It's very complicated math. but they would iron themselves out. And aha, we're back to a stable solar system, all is well. We can be satisfied theologically. Now, as a side note, I should add that a couple hundred years later, current science believes this is a little more complicated.
And yeah, and I know you've read some of the work of Luke Barnes, who's made some very important distinctions here, that Laplace didn't solve it all, did he, back then?
Right, right. So it's today physicists make long computer simulations and try and determine whether it actually is stable or not. The thinking is it probably is stable, but it's actually a probabilistic problem. It's more complicated. Yeah. But back to our story. So Laplace was very satisfied with this. And another side note is that when Napoleon read the work, he said, "Well, very good, but where's God in all of this?" And Laplace is said to have famously retorted, "I have no need of that hypothesis." And so where this took Laplace was he got very carried away and very encouraged by his solutions and how with this new classical physics, you could basically solve and predict everything. And this took him to determinism. If you had a big enough computer and if you knew all the initial conditions, granted, this would not be feasible. No one could actually do this because the universe is too big and so forth. But what's important is in principle, you could predict from the beginning of the universe to the end. Everything is predicted. That's full-blown determinism. That's where it took Laplace. Now, so that's kind of the historical backdrop that's important to understand in all of these discussions. The next way you can look at this whole thing is the adequacy of his claim. Because his claim that there are these deterministic laws of nature, and from them we can predict the entire future of the universe, that has endured well. And when we talk about Sabine Hostetfelder and others, it's a very popular, she's a good entry point, but this is a very popular idea today. And it's linked tightly with evolutionary theory, this idea that everything is determined. There's multiple positions on this, but there's this fairly sizable camp that holds to the kind of the hard over extreme of the spectrum that everything can be predicted in principle. So Laplace's view holds today for a sizable chunk of the people who worry about this sort of thing. And since then, though, the adequacy of this has fallen into question. You have a lot of very interesting new developments after Laplace. There's, of course, relativity. There's quantum mechanics. There's chaos theory. There's statistical mechanics. A lot of new things that Laplace never imagined bring into question the adequacy of the basic claim. Now, this gets very complicated. I don't want to get into all those details, but suffice it to say that the folks in this camp will reject that and say, no, don't worry about all that. This all holds. But there's other very qualified physicists who will take the opposite and view, such as Jeremy England at MIT, who says, no, you know, there's a lot of phenomena here that we do not treat with these deterministic laws of nature. So that's right. Just kind of another interesting angle on this, is the adequacy is not altogether clear. Now it starts to get more interesting if we move on a little bit and start to actually look at what exactly are the claims here and what exactly is the evidence. And this is where we bring in free will, because the camp that is hard over on determinism is also going to be hard over on there's no such thing as free will. And now we bring in a mountain of evidence that is contrary to Laplace and contrary to the entire, this extreme position of determinism. And that is namely free will. We exercise free will all the time. I just dropped my pen because I decided to. I decided to join this podcast today with you, Mike, and talk to you. We do this all the time from when we make, from 24/7, right? And
sure. And our immediate experience of our own as agents making these decisions is so much more clear than the details of the theoretical physics. We know it so well, right?
Right, exactly. The layman in the street knows this better than Sabine Hassenfelder. There is an enormous mountain of evidence. To deny the evidence of free will would be like a fish denying water. Right? It's just that doesn't say maybe there's something non-intuitive here. Maybe there's a way around this. Maybe it doesn't count. But that argument needs to be made. Here's where I think it gets interesting for people in this camp. And Sabine Hostetfelder is simply an example, an entryway here. is that there's an irrational treatment of the evidence. They don't provide a reasoned argument, a balanced argument that weighs the argument on the different side, the evidence on the different sides of the issue. Instead, it's a irrational rejection of the free will evidence that we have. They simply, with a wave of the hand, toss it aside as, oh, well, that's an illusion. Okay, well, why is it an illusion? Aside from the fact that it would support your idea to call it an illusion. And that's simply all they have. This is what's this is what I find fascinating. And we find this in evolution as well. Evolutionary theory and evolution discussions is this irrational treatment of evidence. To them, it is so clear that their position is true that they don't feel a need, they don't feel a burden to defend or even provide a balanced explanation of the evidence. It's just, well, it's just obvious. And it reminds me of Alfred North Whitehead's advice that when you are debating a position or critiquing a position, do not attack the arguments that the other side feels they need to make, but attack the underlying assumptions they feel they have no need to defend. And that's what I think applies here so well. He was prescient on that. The rejection of the mountain of free will evidence out of hand reveals there's something funny going on here. They've got a preconception that they hold dear that is not vulnerable to the evidence. It's very interesting to look at this. And, you know, I lay this out in my blog and I lay this out in my videos, and the comments continue to be oblivious to this. People think, well, so what? It's an illusion. Okay, well, why is it an illusion? So very interesting. I think an irrational element is revealed. And I like this determinism debate for this reason. It really kind of shines a light and reveals this whole aspect of the debate, which is also so common with evolutionary debates and discussions. Another angle on this.
Cornelius, let's have you come back for another podcast to get that additional angle. Let me just kind of summarize where we've been. We're looking at determinism and free will, at how the evidence for free will is overwhelming, and yet these arguments for determinism often just ignore that mountain of evidence, and that's an interesting observation in and of itself. So when we have you back, let's get into additional angles on this question of determinism and free will and how it relates to the latest work of theoretical physicists like Sabina Hosenfelder. So thanks for coming on board and having a chat on ID the Future.
Look forward to it, Mike. Thank you.
I'm Mike Keyes, and thank you for joining us at ID the Future.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.